And this guy loved to hunt. He just went out hunting all the time, getting a lot of stuff. And you would think that because food gets shared widely in these societies, that that would be a good thing. But it wasn't. And so people don't like that. They don't like when you set yourself above them. And he eventually got, if you go back to hunting and gathering life, yeah, you might die a violent death, but your life is probably very meaningful. And is that worth the trade-off?
Welcome back to Radius of Reason, a show where we talk about the various interconnected problems faced by humanity. My name is Andre, and I'm joined by my co-host, Levon.
Today's guest is Dr. Vivek Venkatraman, who's an evolutionary anthropologist at the University of Calgary. For over a decade, he's traveled to Malaysia to study the Batek people, a modern hunter-gatherer tribe. Dr. Venkatraman has lived side by side with these people and is even one of only 3,000 speakers of their language.
We talked to Dr. Venkatraman about hunter-gatherer societies, their way of life, what lessons industrialized society can learn from these people, and ultimately, if hunter-gatherers are happier than we are. We even talk about dating apps and how dating apps are impacting the Batek people today.
Dr. Venkatraman, for someone listening to this, what do you think is the most eye-opening part about living as a hunter-gatherer, and how might that experience change their view of modern life?
Well, I think there's many answers to that question, but I'll start off with the thing that immediately popped to mind, which is how social they are. I have experience living with hunter-gatherers in the jungles of Malaysia. I've worked for over 10 years with a group called the Batek, and life there it's really social. It's highly cooperative. On a day-to-day basis, you're kind of with people all the time. And as a person coming from westernized society, where I'm used to having privacy and, having some solitude, which I personally like, that can actually be very jarring. But their social systems, their high levels of cooperation are part of what makes a hunter-gatherer a hunter-gatherer. And it's part of what made us human. So the complete lack of privacy and constant interaction with other people is one of the really striking features of living with these groups.
Do you have like a story that you tell to illustrate like just the stark contrast in this relationship with privacy? Like what moment could you like describe that to us would seem just like a totally normal expectation, whereas they're like, absolutely not? No.
Well, sure. I can give you a pretty extreme example where, I was living in a jungle camp once and, you got to find a place to go to the bathroom, and there's really... no obvious, there's no latrines, there's no places to go. It's just the woods. I think they're particularly worried about us as, people who are in their care, so to speak. And so if you try to go off and go to the bathroom, literally the entire camp will just look at you and say, "Where are you going?" so that happens a lot. Or, another striking thing is, a lot of us, when we sleep, we like peace and quiet, right? And the jungle is actually pretty nice because it has like this white noise in the background of animals and like insects and so on. And that's kind of nice. But in these small camps where it'll just be a series of huts clustered together, within 20, 30 meters, lying awake at night, people are awake at all times doing things, chatting, screaming, whatever it is, there's always activity. And so hunter-gatherer camps are really loud. And that's one thing. I don't always sleep great there because of that. And there's some places also that'll have dogs, and that can make it like extra loud. So life is just, it can be very kind of chaotic and loud, but that's a part of their world. I don't think they're as disturbed by it as me and my fellow field researchers are. But
I wonder if are you working as hard as they are in terms of like calorie expenditure? Because I would imagine that you would get so tired if you were doing all that labor that you would be able to sleep through the noise. But maybe as a visitor, You're not kind of doing quite the same. I don't know.
Yeah, well, the issue of work is interesting, especially when it comes to doing field work, because it's extremely hard work. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily physically demanding from the field worker perspective, because, okay, what am I doing all day? I'm basically sitting with people, interviewing them, speaking in their language, writing things down. Malaysia, you know, being right next to the equator is extremely hot. So, mm-hmm. And very humid as well in the jungle. So I feel like I burn a lot of energy, but I'm not like, I don't ever exercise in the field. You know, I'll go on hikes and sometimes walk with them to forage and things like that. But they never really take us in anything hardcore. I mean, we're viewed as just like total wusses out there. We're more likely to be stuck with the children gathering fruits and things. But like, if there's a guy going hunting and he's going to be gone for a day or two, there's no way he would want to compromise his chance at getting game by having us like fall and, you know, give up your location if you're trying to ambush hunt. So yeah, I'm super tired, and sometimes that does get you through the night, but it's a completely different kind of life than it is living in an industrialized society. And that's partly why I like it. You know, I can go for a couple months a year or these days now that I have kids, far less than that, but it's just such a change of environment, and it makes you question everything that you see as normal in your own life. It's actually, you realize, oh, that's just how I've been enculturated. Life could be totally different. I could have different preferences and likes and dislikes if I was raised in a different society. And I think that's really the goal of anthropology, frankly, is to make you realize that fact.
Hey guys, if you're enjoying the show, don't forget to leave a comment. Let us know what you think about literally every single thing that we've talked about thus far.
To support our work, please also be sure to subscribe to our channel. You'll also get notifications when the newest episode drops.
Yeah. Could you take us through a day in the life of a hunter-gatherer? And however you want to do this, whether you want to mix in prehistoric hunter-gatherers and modern hunter-gatherers, whatever you think makes sense, just to give us kind of an overview of the different activities that one would partake in.
I'll start with what I know best, which is modern hunter-gatherers like the Batek. They get up about the same time that I think we would, you know, between 6 and 8 in the morning. They live in lean-to huts made of bamboo and thatching material. And they're kind of, as the name indicates, they're kind of just open, right? It's kind of just like a leaning type thing. And they sleep under the shelter. It's a really comfortable place to sleep. You know, it's kind of culturally adapted for the jungle environment. So yeah, people sleep in those wake up around 6 to 8, have some breakfast, typically kind of alone with your family, something light. Mealtime isn't a huge affair, I would say, as it can sometimes be in our society. It's just kind of like informally kind of eating with your family. And in this environment, they might be eating things like leftover rice from the night before or some tubers. These are kind of like jungle French fries that they collect that are underground, and then they will like boil them or fry them up. So that's kind of the breakfast. And then people go to, I guess we could call it work. but let's imagine, you know, so in hunter-gatherer societies, you typically have this sexual division of labor where men tend to do the hunting, women tend to do the gathering, although that is a pretty porous boundary. People cooperate in groups. So you go out to hunt, you might go with a few other guys. The thing about hunting is that it's risky, meaning that there's a high chance of failure. So you might go out for a couple hours and not get anything, but you're, you know, out there kind of hiking all day. And in this particular group I work with, they use poison-tipped darts that are shot with a blowpipe. And they'll get things like monkeys and gibbons and birds and things like that. So yeah, the men will be out all day. I'd say the foraging days between, you know, 4 and 6 hours. They kind of do like a loop back to the camp. And then women will go in groups gathering, going after fruits. Tubers are a big thing in this society. And then kind of another notable feature is, you know, what are the kids doing, right? There's no daycares in hunter-gatherer society, or they look very different. And so the kids will either go out with foragers, and this is when they get to learn skills that they will use later in life. or they might stay back at camp. But the real important feature of these groups of children is that they're mixed age, right? So you have young kids being kind of babysat by the older kids. And that's kind of the environment that they're in throughout their life. And so that's kind of the working day. And then you get back and you kind of just hang out. Oh, and by the way, when you're out, you might, you know, smoke some cigarettes, take a break, take a nap, right? Napping is pretty common. But then when you're back for the day, you might take another nap, hang out with people. You might process food that you got that day, right? If it needs to be, you know, leached of toxins or cooked or butchered. And then at night, people just kind of just hang out. And the sun goes down there, you know, pretty early, 6:30 or 7. Oh, wow. And so, yeah. And then people might go to sleep early, but then wake up in the middle of the night. Some hunter-gatherers show what's called polyphasic or biphasic sleep, where they sleep for a couple hours, wake up, go do things, eat, whatever it is, and then go back to sleep. So it's not necessarily this big, long, like 9-hour chunk that we try to optimize in our society.
I think I was supposed to be a hunter-gatherer.
It sounds pretty good overall, right? It sounds pretty good. So, and I think
you mentioned cigarettes. Are there any other kind of telltale signs of maybe the, I don't want to call it like the outside world, but maybe the trappings of like commercial products entering into their society? Like, is there any additional, like the proverbial like Coke bottle that's thrown down from the airplane or something?
Oh, yeah,
like that?
Yeah. Well, these days, frankly, you're not going to really find any populations around the globe that are not or that are untouched by,
besides like the Sentinel Islands or something like
outside
that.
Outside civilization, except maybe Sentinel Island. Yeah, exactly.
Hey, everybody. If you want to support our channel, please be sure to subscribe to get the latest updates on our work.
And of course, let us know in the comments how you think we're doing, what we can improve, and so on.
Always love hearing from you.
The Batak have, you know, like Malaysia is a pretty small country, right? They're, Kuala Lumpur is a huge city. It can be just a couple hours away from these places that I'm talking about. So it's actually remarkable that they're still living this way of life. But they kind of take in what they want and what they need from the outside world. And then they don't take in what they don't want, right? Like, they're not that interested in sending their kids to outside schools. It does happen a little bit, but not that interested in that. But if we talk about basic amenities, yeah, of course, right? Why wouldn't you want to be able to go to a store and buy sugar and salt and tobacco and things like that? So, yeah, they love to smoke in this group. And they'll get kind of loose leaf tobacco from the outside shops, but they actually roll them generally with leaves from the rainforest that they kind of just dry out, and then they roll it up. And it's actually, I've tried one of these. It's kind of cool. So it's not this like highly industrialized cigarette, although there is some of that too. And then clothing, phones, these are all starting to come in more and more. But one of the things that we like to study is how do they decide what to use,
right, precisely,
what not to use. Yeah. So it's really fascinating time.
What has been like the Batak position on the smartphone? I mean, what is it?
Yeah, people seem to like them. You know, if you have WhatsApp, you can communicate now with all these people that before you might have to go for a couple day hike or a journey up the river to go see your extended family. And so it's kind of created these networks that didn't exist before. And I think people like that. And interestingly, online dating is also now a thing.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. In Malaysia, it's really fascinating, and it's leading to more intermarriage between different ethnic groups. So just to back up one second, I study the Orang Asli, which means original people of Peninsular Malaysia. Mm-hmm. And the Batak are only one of those. There's about 20 different groups, and they all have different subsistence histories in terms of being farmers or hunter-gatherers. And yeah, so, you know, they live close by to each other. And so there's more intermarriage now as a result of this online dating stuff. But that being said, they might still live out in the middle of nowhere and produce all their own food.
How much intertribal marriages were there like before the dating apps took over?
It's hard to say, but I don't think there was too much of it. I mean, it definitely existed, but I think at pretty low level simply due to the constraints of geography and travel. So I don't have a number, but certainly the modern these modern amenities have kind of transformed their world. Yeah.
And what about like the kind of partnerships that they have romantically? Is it mainly like pair bonded or something else?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the Botec Society, and I would say most hunter-gatherers are basically serial monogamists. Hmm. Okay, so they get married to somebody, and we should use that term very differently than we use it here, where it involves this essentially a very lengthy binding legal contract, right, to be married. There, what it means is, okay, let's go hang out in the same hut together. Maybe we'll have a kid. And then a couple of years pass, and sometimes people stay together and sometimes they break up, but they won't go far. And then they'll typically pair up with someone else. And so it produces this dynamic where you're constantly surrounded by your family and by your kind of previous families. But what's striking is there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of, at least like explicit jealousy or weirdness around that. And people will readily talk about like, oh, this person used to be married to that person there, and they're right over there. They're married to that person now. Hmm. So, and this was kind of the early studies of the Botec by my advisors, Kirk and Karen Endicott at Dartmouth. They were the ones to really explore this at first. And it's kind of led to the idea that hunter-gatherers, there is kind of like sexual jealousy and stuff, but I don't think it's as rampant as it is in kind of our society informed by Judeo-Christian norms. And so I find the marriage and the dating and stuff there really fascinating, because the other side of it is if you get divorced, you just move to a new hut. There's no papers. Yeah. Well,
so, I mean, do you think that this kind of more casual approach to dating, or I don't know if casual is the right characterization here, but is it just because the dating pool is so much smaller and there isn't as much of a sense of like, oh, there could be greater choice out there, and there isn't as much pressure put on settling down or finding a partner? What kind of characterizes this kind of more laissez-faire attitude that you're describing?
Well, part of it is simply the society that they live in, which is really egalitarian. And this is one of the defining features of a lot of modern hunter-gatherers, where people can't tell each other what to do. There's a lot of permissiveness around behavior. And this, like the famous ethnography written about this group, the Botec, is called the Gender Egalitarian Botec of Malaysia. So it was kind of notoriously gender egalitarian as well, meaning that, you know, men and women are kind of free to do as they choose, whether it's, you know, what you do with your day, whether you hunt and gather, or in kind of like familial and sexual relations. So I think that is sort of part of it. The other is that, yeah, these are like relatively small societies. There still is mostly marriage within the group, although there is dispersal, right? Like you can't stay in like literally the exact same group you're in, because there's probably a lot of relatives around, right? And so you may have to kind of go one or two towns over. And this was true years ago as well. So you do have that kind of dispersal. I think those are kind of the main factors that lead to this kind of more laissez-faire existence. And I don't know, it seems kind of healthier to me, frankly, than a lot of what we have here.
Well, it couldn't be less healthy, that's for sure. What about the difference with prehistoric hunter-gatherers? Like, you know, say you've got a Native American tribe 50,000 years ago, what would be the big highlights there if you were doing another day in the life?
Yeah, well, it's important to recognize that we look at modern hunter-gatherers today, and as anthropologists, our goal is to understand what drives variation between them, right? Mm-hmm. So we want to emphasize this idea that there's no single hunter-gatherer group alive today that is more representative of the human past than any other. The more interesting way to look at it is to look at all the hunter-gatherers and then to ask, what makes these people do that and these people do the opposite, right? And so we typically look to environmental, ecological factors, and then we look at social factors as well. And that's a really powerful approach then for kind of retrodicting those patterns into the past. Just to give you one concrete example, when should you hunt and when should you gather, or what proportion of them should you do? Well, this varies by latitude. So if you live in the high north where there's not as many plants, basically, the diet is more meat than it is plants. Whereas if you go to the tropics where there's more plants, it's a little bit more even. And so because that's such a kind of strong pattern among modern hunter-gatherers, we can say, well, if people had the same constraints as they do in the present as in the past as they do in the present, then that pattern should hold up too. And we should see those kind of like latitudinal patterns. Now that's a pretty straightforward one. It can get more complicated, but I'll just say first that, you know, we're trying to understand variation. And so when we look at hunter-gatherers in the past, the fact is their lives were very different. Like, we don't really know all that much, I have to say. We have archaeological remains of places they lived and tools that they used, which are very different than what hunter-gatherers have now that have much more elaborate toolkits. But hunter-gatherers, you know, 50, 100,000 years ago, who were mostly using, you know, wood and stone as their tools, that would have made life different in a lot of ways. It would have made getting food harder than if you have poison tipped blow darts or, you know, bows and arrows, which are relatively recent. So weaponry would have been different, right? They would have, you know, I think spears and sticks would have been really important. We can look at environments also, like there would have been more megafauna out in the landscape, right? Imagine living in a world with giant ground sloths and, I mean, what else? Like mastodons, woolly rhinoceros, things like that, saber-toothed cats. you know, it would have been a totally different world that our ancestors were occupying. And so one idea that I'm sympathetic toward is that there was more large game cooperative hunting in the past, right? So instead of going after these small animals like monkeys and gibbons and things like that, like the Batek do, maybe it was more common in the past to be in groups of 20 or 30 people going after, you know, the mastodon. There's a really cool example just a few hours from my house here in Canada, in Alberta, a place called Head Smash in Buffalo Jump. And this
the
is
Buffalo Cliff. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So indigenous peoples used to locate buffalo herds and then kind of scare them to going near the cliffs. And then they would start a stampede. And this would be a big affair. Like, lots of people would be needed to kind of corral them in. And then they would get them to stampede off the cliff, resulting in just what must have been a massive slaughter with, you know.
And you've written about this particular kind of phenomena of like the Buffalo Cliff and like the herding of large groups of these buffalo into like one area. And I think you also alluded to the fact that this did contribute to some of this egalitarianism that's even described in prehistoric societies, that you'd have to kind of rely on all genders to participate in this sort of like herding system of sorts, that you needed both men and women to contribute to that equally. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, to back up a little bit, to give listeners a sense of why I brought that up, is that there's been a debate recently in anthropology that I've been a part of about the prevalence of women's hunting in modern hunter-gatherer societies, as well as in the past. The question being, the sexual divisions of labor that we see among modern hunter-gatherers, did they also exist in the past? And if so, how far back? Now, I've argued, so I've done some work on women's hunting, which is not super common, but it does happen. And I've argued that in the past, women may have played a pretty prominent role in this hunting behavior. And I don't think it would have been like close range killing, but probably they were involved in the parts of the buffalo hunt where they were kind of corralling the animal toward the cliff, doing a lot of important logistical help with butchering, things like that. And this is based on what we see in modern hunter-gatherers about how women end up contributing, because having dependent offspring, frankly, they're simply too valuable to be doing close range killing, whereas men are much more expendable in a lot of ways. And so that's why I think you see that. That's why I think you see that difference. And so, yeah, that's like one way in which the past may have been different. I wouldn't be surprised if women were involved in hunting more in the past than we actually see in the present.
What about, you know, I think a lot of your writing mentions this big conference that happened in Chicago.
In 1966, yeah.
There you go.
And there was this idea of, like, you know, the original affluent society being these hunter-gatherer tribes who have all this abundance in terms of resources and abundance in terms of leisure time because they didn't really have to work that hard. What are your thoughts on that?
It's probably one of the most influential ideas in anthropology. And so at that conference at Man the Hunter, there was a anthropologist named Marshall Sollins, and he was a professor at the University of Michigan at this time. He was like this kind of far left a professor who had done some kind of theoretical work in anthropology, but this would be his most famous contribution in a lot of ways. And what he did was he surveyed data from the hunter-gatherer societies where they had measured what we call time allocation, basically how are you spending your time. And he came to the conclusion that life as a hunter-gatherer was pretty good. It was pretty leisurely. And one of the sources of data was from Richard Lee, who's an anthropologist based at Toronto. He's one of the co-editors of that conference and the volume. And he did probably the most cutting-edge study at that time, where he was with Kung hunter-gatherers in Southern Africa. And when he looked at what people were doing, he calculated they were working about 20 hours, like 15 to 20 hours per week. And that number would later be revised based on the inclusion of food processing time. But at the time of the conference, it was like, okay, 20 hours. Now, it's important to couch that in kind of the broader history of anthropology, where before that, most people saw hunter-gatherers as savages, essentially, who were kind of scraping by, that had this really impoverished existence, that they were constantly under threat of starvation, and they weren't intellectually capable of having the technologies that could elevate them above nature. They were kind of like part of nature, right? That's how things were seen then. And so that's why Sollins' contribution was so important, because it said, no, wait a second, if we actually look at the data, it seems like hunter-gatherers are pretty leisurely and they have plenty to eat. They're quite healthy. So we call that the original affluent society. You know, really compelling story, and we always have to look at things the way that people saw them at the time and the data that they had at the time. So it was perhaps pretty reasonable. But in recent years, I think the idea has, if not fallen apart, maybe just gotten more complicated to maybe a place in the middle, like maybe the pendulum had swung a little bit too far. And I wrote an article about this in the online venue Eon, where I kind of analyzed what we know now about hunter-gatherer work and subsistence and energetics from a 21st century perspective. And if you want, we can kind of delve into that. But the punchline of that is that hunter-gatherers, they work, it depends on how we define work, but they spend less of their day finding food than the great apes do. They spend about half their day foraging, half of like daylight hours foraging, which ends up, as I said before, being like 4 to 6 hours per day, which isn't, you know, that isn't really toiling on the one hand, but what our research has shown, and this is done with kind of cutting edge energetic studies where we take out fancy equipment to the field and measure what people do when they're foraging, it turns out that human foraging is very expensive energetically. Hmm. So our strategy as humans has been to compress the foraging day to be shorter so you can go chill later, but you work hard during that time. So it's intensive, but it's short. And then if we revisit original affluence, we say, okay, how do we judge this now? I think it shows that it's both true and untrue. Hunter-gatherers work hard, but they do work like not that much in evolutionary perspective, and certainly less than the Goldman Sachs analysts working 100 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
So we get more into that study if you want, but yeah.
Yeah, well, I was also going to ask, you know, in terms of injuries and disease and, you know, and all that, I mean, health, infant mortality rate, we know was very high back in the day. Like, how does that impact someone thinking about hunter-gatherer affluence?
Well, I think that's a critical thing to think about. And I think that's what most people point to when they say that modern life is better, right? Who of us would give up modern amenities when it comes to health? I was gonna say, who would give up vaccines? But obviously a lot of people would.
Yeah.
Right. But like most people are like pretty reasonable about this and realize that there's a lot to be gained by kind of modern medicine. Now in the past, as you know, you're correct to say that if you just do the math and look at human population growth rates over the past couple hundred thousand years, about half of kids were dying up until very recent times, right? So, and it would have been from things that we now see, in at least in the industrialized world, as something that is very treatable and avoidable. Things like diarrhea, you know, the simplest of communicable diseases, basically. So, yeah, for a lot of people, it's about life becoming, in a sense, safer and more healthy, and that is probably the most important thing to people. I'm sure we could have an entire podcast about safety culture and what that means. But I think that if most people are given this kind of cost benefit, I think safety and health would figure prominently. And I think there's a strong argument that we have it pretty good. But there's also some other aspects that are negative. That
I think that also opens up some philosophical questions that I do want to touch on later on. But maybe we can get to like the direct comparisons between, you know, modern life and hunter-gatherer life. I think this is where we're going to run into some interesting ideas. So when we're talking about, you know, if hunter-gatherers were happier than modern people, I think, you know, it kind of begs the question, what do you mean by happy and all these things? Like, I like to think of it in terms of what Daniel Kahneman, how he framed things in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, where you've got the experiencing self and you've got the remembering self. The experiencing self is more of like this hedonistic angle to it, the intuitive in the moment thing. And the remembering self is, you know, was this memory of a thing meaningful, fulfilling? Am I satisfied with my life looking back? So from that standpoint, there's obviously been tons of trade-offs made here. We just talked about the health being, you know, something that you would definitely put on the, you know, the modern societies. You would put that check on the side of modern society. What do you think is most favorable for hunter-gatherers if you were doing that comparison?
Yeah, well, I think lots of things. To get back to the work stuff for a moment, I think there's a strong argument that their work lives are much more rewarding than ours. you know, going back to egalitarianism, like there are no bosses here, right? You literally cannot boss someone around. You would be ostracized if you were to try and bully somebody or make them work for you. And this is one reason that the Batek now are rejecting these like work opportunities in which they could have a regular wage, let's say working in a plantation or a store or something not far from where they live. None of them ever want to do that. And when I ask them why, it's because they don't want to have a boss. They don't want to be bossed around. And I think that these kinds of hierarchies have become very natural for us. But at the same time, we kind of hate them, right? People don't like the boss. They don't like these staggering levels of income inequality that we see in the world. Mm-hmm. I think there is a strong argument to be made that these are relatively novel in human evolution, although there's a lot of caveats and it's more complicated than I think some people make it out to be. So yeah, working life, you know, take it for what you will. The other thing is like hunter-gatherer work is, okay, if your work for the day is going out hunting and like taking a nap and smoking some cigarettes, that probably sounds to you like a day off, right? That sounds to a lot of Americans like a weekend. right? So when we use the word work, you know, in our studies, we have equated work with the amount of time you're spending going after your food, because we, in our society, we then work for our food. So you can make this direct comparison, and I think that's valuable. But I'm very cognizant that even labeling what hunter-gatherers do as work is potentially inaccurate, right? So there's the work side of things. And then to go back to what I started the podcast with would be interactions with others and the society and cooperation. Our society is currently undergoing this epidemic of loneliness, basically, right? We see it in old age. We see it with kids who are addicted to digital media. And this is something that you just don't see in these societies, or at least not yet. You know, we're trying to capture this inaction.
Even though they do have, as you mentioned, access to some of these devices, for instance, that, you know, a child in the United States might be hooked on, you know, constantly watching YouTube videos. It seems that what you're saying is, even if the technology is present, they're not necessarily using it in the same way, maybe for escapism, that somebody in the US would be using it.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think they might if they had more opportunity. But if you want to live in the jungle where your family is, you're not going to get good cell phone reception. And so I'm already seeing the trend toward kind of like face on the phone kind of behavior. But it's simply not logistically possible a lot of the time. And people are still, you know, there's no like physical boundaries of like go into your house and close the door and just spend time in your room. That isn't really possible. So life ends up just inherently being a little bit more social. And then, you know, to add on to that point further, it would be the cultures around childcare that I think are much healthier in these societies. You know, I'm experiencing this now with, you know, two young kids and how difficult it is to take care of two young kids. You know, we live away from our families who are on the East Coast. We're in the West of Canada. And in these hunter-gatherer societies, you could just take your baby and hand it to anybody and just go do something. There's always free daycare available by your kin. That's a major difference. Yeah.
Let's go through a thought experiment here. So let's say the reception was better, and they had the latest phones,
Starlink.
And the kids, like, they didn't want to go hunt, they didn't want to go gather, they didn't want to do anything. They were just like glued to their phone. Like, how would the adults in that society respond?
That's interesting, because on the one hand, it's not really a culture where you scream at somebody and say, "Get off your phone." I think what this goes to show is that, like, the phone use problem in our society is that it's not just the phone. Like, yeah, it is dialed in to push these psychological buttons that lead to addiction, right? And I think that would have the same effect among other people as well, like bright screens, algorithms, right? They're like slot machines. I think they would potentially fall prey to that as well. But I think if you have a society that's otherwise shaped in a way that is geared toward cooperation, where you have other responsibilities and expectations from others about your behavior, then I think that serves as kind of a cultural buffer against what we're seeing in our society, where we're already so apart from each other in terms of the nuclear family living in your own house without much support, that when you introduce this addictive technology, it just kind of spirals out of control. Whereas I think it would be arrested sooner in these societies because of the broader social context.
Are you noticing any sort of like schism in younger generations of the bot tech with previous generations? I mean, those that maybe are a little bit more in tune with technology, that are integrating it a bit more into their lifestyle. Is there kind of a sort of kids these days moment that older generations are experiencing?
Absolutely. And I talk to them about this all the time. I'll talk to older people and they'll say, like, the kids these days don't know anything. Like, that's literally exactly what they say.
Standard.
In terms of, yeah, like hunting skill, knowledge of their culture, history. And they are quite concerned about it. And Yeah, I guess I don't take it lightly because I can kind of see it too. People are just, you know, they're drawn to the city, they're drawn to cell phones, they're drawn to motorbikes, and you can kind of see why. And so a lot of them are seeing more outside opportunities to interact with the broader world, and those are attractive, and you can't really blame them for it, right? It kind of makes sense. And so we see this schism for sure. And there's even some camps that I've visited and heard about that consists mainly of old people, and they're really deep in the jungle. And it's just like, they want to live their life the way it was before, but the younger people like to be kind of closer to the outside world so they can get these amenities. Yeah.
Do they ever, I mean, are there stories of the younger people returning to the tribes after having tried
exposure
out
the
city?
Like, you know, the Rumspringa of the Batek, so to
speak. Yeah, exactly. Well, it's certainly not a, like an ingrained cultural behavior kind of like that, or like a rite of passage, I guess. But you do have people who will go to the cities and then they realize they hate it and it sucks. Right? Like, you're working as a security guard working the graveyard shift and it's like, no, this sucks. I'm going to go back to my village.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. There's stories of, you know, during the American Indian War where European settlers would be captured by Native American tribes. And yeah. When offered the opportunity to return, they would refuse to do so. Or when they were forced to in prisoner exchanges, they would still go back to the Native American tribes. And I think, like, I mean, that to me, that's so profound. And the fact that you just mentioned that it also happens, at least on some occasions, with the Batek, like that, I mean, that should say something. Like, we've made all of this progress, you know, post agricultural revolution. And yet people still rather go back. So I think that is a pretty, like, almost damning.
But I'm curious what the like how much of those instances of individuals choosing to return to their previous way of life are overshadowed by a far greater amount of people moving away from these traditional communities. And I'm thinking about, like, I was reading an article about Italy not long ago, where a lot of the villages in Tuscany and other, like, rural areas are just completely dying out because, again, like, the only people who live there are of a much older generation, and young people just don't want to stay in these communities because they feel isolated and they feel like any opportunity they have to advance themselves is in a more urban area. So they go to Florence, they go to Rome, they might leave Italy altogether. And it is creating this phenomena of places that are, you know, historically rich, that played really significant roles in the cultural boom of the Renaissance, are just dying out. And I wonder if that is inevitably the fate that some of these Batek communities are going to be facing, if younger generations are going to be going to, you know, work as security guards in Kuala Lumpur or something like that.
Well, I think it's useful to look at it in terms of, like, the push and the pull, right? People are pulled towards some things, they're attracted toward them. In other cases, you get kind of pushed toward it essentially involuntarily. Like, if they cut down the rainforest and put a plantation and try and proselytize you to change.
Is that happening? Right? Like, is there this encroachment?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of encroachment, a lot of forced conversion, because the government and kind of like the broader Malaysian society, frankly, they have a relatively arcane view of hunter-gatherers and, like, who these people are. They kind of see them still as savages. They don't like the nomadic lifestyle. You know, they want them to be upstanding citizens who are in one place paying their taxes and so on. And so there is a lot of pressure to turn them into being more like Malays. And when you exert this pressure over decades and decades, like, it's going to work at some level, right? Now, as far as the Native American stories, I mean, I put a lot of stock in those as well. I think they're really powerful stories. And if you look at the reasons that people give, they tend to be around how social those groups are, right? How cooperative they are, and how much more freedom they feel like they have in these indigenous societies that kind of value individual difference more. So I think it's just incredibly powerful. And when we look at this sweep of history, it's really tragic to think about all this diversity and like interesting forms of human cooperation that are being lost through the kind of centralizing influences of states. You know, these days I'm super interested in other kinds of anarchist formations that arise, whether it's pirates or people who are subject to disasters like plane crashes or shipwrecks, how they form their own societies, and they kind of inherently move toward these cooperative structures that you actually see in hunter-gatherers. So I think there's something deep within us that leads to that.
Yeah, no. I think the issue becomes like a game theory thing where once you know there's other tribes that might be trying to, you know, take over or steal your resources or whatever, although it's different with hunter-gatherers because they don't accumulate resources in the same way. But there is a game theoretic dynamic that emerges, you know, when tribes start to compete with one another, or in the case of like the Batak and, you know, city life in Malaysia, it could be that people think, well, I like my status is low being in this tribe, mm-hmm. and I to increase my status, I have to go out to the city. And, you know, by the time you're there, you know, you've got the comfort, you've got the safety. You may or may not have the status, but like all of that dictates whether you really want to go back, because man, it goes back to the philosophical question of what do you value, you know? And I think you're right. I think history has proven that humans have chosen comfort and safety and survival and reproduction, right? Because, you know, you have the lower infant mortality rates, you have, yeah, just all those material benefits. But you have traded these other things, which if you ask people what they want, like they also want happiness. Like the enlightened individual in theory, like wants the meaning and the fulfillment of a life well lived. But the more primitive aspects of our being demand that these material benefits are met first, right? And right. So the meaning and stuff is a surplus, and that's kind of the duality of modern life and the decision that some people are forced to make, you know, with pursuing a more or less meaningful job versus paying, you know, for childcare or, you know, something like that. Yeah. And I just think, like, in the past, people didn't have to make that choice because it was consistent. It was aligned, and now it's totally misaligned.
Yeah, totally. I often think, you know, would people prefer this life of safety or something kind of more meaningful? Because people are lacking meaning, I think, as well as kind of religions have fallen by the wayside, and the non-religious world has not come up with kind of an alternative form of cooperation that binds people in the same way that that religion has. But, you know, if you go back to hunting and gathering life, yeah, you might die of some communicable disease. You might die in a raid. You might die a violent death. But your life is probably very meaningful. And is that worth the trade-off? I think what we see in biology kind of on the grand scale is that there's always trade-offs. There's trade-offs in everything. And even I think we're realizing now the trade-offs that come with the healthcare system, because we have essentially solved the issues of parasites so well that our bodies are actually attacking themselves. They're getting bored, yeah. And we have this kind of chronic, you know, inflammation that seems to actually be at the root of like a lot of issues, whether it's arthritis to dementias to you know, mental health ailments. And so there truly is a trade-off in what you want to be dying from or potentially dying from. That, yeah, it just shows that there's, yeah, always trade-offs.
How do you measure satisfaction when it comes to gaining like or understanding the perspective of the Batak or any other hunter-gathering society? I mean, what how do you even philosophically communicate the question of like, oh yeah, are you enjoying your life? Like, are you happy? I mean, is it as simple as just asking that? Is there an easy answer to get from a question like that? Or is there another like methodological way that you approach these sorts of things with?
It's really tough. And this is kind of one of the challenges of field research in general, which is you want to get data that's comparable, say, to industrialized societies. And so you want to have the prompts and the questions be as similar as possible. But then it creates the issue that you're kind of mentioning here, which is, well, are you asking the same question, right? So I think there is a way to go about it. You know, one question is there like a direct translation of that word and does it have the same connotation?
Oh, Christ. Yeah.
Right. You know, you can kind of get at it that way. And so people take these survey instruments developed in industrialized contexts, translate them. And it would be something like, are you satisfied with your life? You know, how many times have you cried in the past week? You can like do an anxiety, depression inventories with these groups. You can ask them about their happiness. And what you see, and there's not much research on this at all. There's like a handful of papers. But what it seems to show is that hunter-gatherers are like overall more satisfied with their lives than other populations. And can you guys guess what, like if you were to ask a hunter-gatherer, what are the main axes that lead to happiness? What would it be? I'm curious what you think. What would be like?
I guess like, I don't know, sex?
Children, sex type of thing, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it ends up being relatively simple things, sort of like, are you successful hunting? Do you have a good mate?
Okay.
Are you successful gathering? Like pretty basic things that come down to like accounting for your basic needs.
Is it different from what someone in, you know, in America would, you know, respond
like an industrial
with like
one?
Yeah, I mean, like if you have a good job and you have a good mate, that's you know, that's, you're pretty likely to be happy. Right.
Yeah, I think it would be somewhat parallel. But then if you look at the parallel of, okay, what is the industrialized parallel of like hunting and gathering? It's like, well, do you like your job? I mean, I think a lot of people might say, no, I hate my boss. Yeah. I'm doing this really specialized routine work that's the same thing all the time. That's another thing about hunter-gatherer work, is that it's highly varied, right? You're always solving kind of new problems with your with your hands and with your mind.
You know, that's another interesting little mismatch, because a lot of people spend a lot of money in modern society to travel. And this novelty seeking thing is like a huge, huge business, really, for that reason. But if you think about it, you know, hunter-gatherers, because they're nomadic, they're always kind of they're always going into new environments, right? And the experience of hunting itself is extraordinarily novel, right? Each hunt is really different. And so I found that to be a pretty interesting thing, because people are very novelty deprived in modern life.
Well, or we have a lot of, or we have so much of it that we're like addicted
to it. And the source of it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's a different, yeah, it's a different type of novelty, I guess.
Yeah. I go back and forth on this about the hunter-gatherer groups, because when I'm living with them, you can get really bored also. Right, like you're sitting in a camp, your phone doesn't work. Yeah,
from
I can
a standpoint
go read a book.
Of a visitor, or it's something that you like see in the Baltic people as well, like the concept of boredom.
Well, I mean, from the standpoint of me visiting, but I can easily imagine how it might be the same for them. Of like, okay, like this is where I live. I might go travel over there for like a few days and come back, but like this is life. Like this is it right here. There's really nowhere else to go.
But you have a reference. I mean, your dopamine sensors are kind of have been, you know, I don't know, pulled in different directions throughout your life, and theirs have been more, you know, stable. I mean, how confident are you in that?
Not super confident. And I think you're right. And I think one thing that proves that is that through time, I get kind of more accustomed to being there, like not only settling in, but I think you can feel how your dopamine system sort of like not needing
the ultimate dopamine fast.
Yeah, no, totally. And it's more about like talking to people. So yeah. I mean, when I come back from the field and come back into my life, I sometimes feel a little bit lonely in like a weird kind of way. Cause like I'm back with my family, right? Like, and that's great. But there's something I almost miss about living in this like chaotic village surrounded by 50 people who are analyzing you all the time. It's really weird. It's a really
have
weird
you, have you taken forth. Any, when you return after a couple of months, maybe when you didn't have children, you'd be gone for longer periods of time.
Yeah.
Did you ever change something in your life in kind of your industrialized society to refine it? Maybe have you adopted any like new habits from just being around the Baltic for an extended period of time?
Yeah, that's a good question because I think my experiences with them very much inform my worldview on these things. Mm-hmm. As far as concrete actions to take, that's a little bit more challenging, right? I mean, I love the outdoors. I like to get out as much as I can. I think mm-hmm. interacting with nature is just really healthy. But, you know, I can't go live in a small village, right? That's like inherently kind of impossible. But just on these kind of micro decisions when it comes to like, okay, I know that socializing is important, or I'm able to have this kind of frame of reference in which I kind of know that our society is poisonous in some ways. I think even having that recognition can be useful for, sometimes for knowing when a situation is kind of unhealthy for you, if that makes sense. It's almost just like a recalibration of like how you see things mm-hmm. that I found really, really useful. But I mean, more generally, doing field work is so difficult and it's always so full of problems and issues that it's helped me maintain a low standard for anything ever like working.
Just out of curiosity, yeah. Do you speak Baltic?
I do. I can speak Baltic. Yeah, there's only about 2,000 speakers. There's a few dialects, so awesome. I can speak like two dialects of Baltic. I can speak Malay as well. But yeah, my PhD was basically going and just living with Baltic, and there's no dictionary, right, for a group like this. And so it's literally just sitting there and pointing at things. Just wow. Complete immersion. But man, you learn really fast when you're genuinely immersed in another culture.
I will say. What's the general like age breakdown of the communities that you lived in? Like who would be the oldest member of like a settlement?
I mean, you get people up to their 80s and 90s. Wow. Yeah, they're around for sure. And then, you know, these days with more outside foods coming in and like cheaper calories, you are starting to see kind of the explosion of kids in some of these more settled areas. Uh-huh. And so, yeah, I mean, it's kind of the same as we see, I guess, maybe a little bit less of the older population because of, you know, it's just a higher mortality world there.
Mm-hmm. To circle back to the question of happiness though, and you know, how you would measure it. There's a great quote from Taoism. It says the Tao that can be spoken is not the eternal Tao. And so I think from your standpoint, what was your experience and feeling of how happy and satisfied these people were with their lives?
I would say pretty happy when they're able to live autonomously and according to their own wishes and desires. As I said, there's so much change going on there now, so that people are being forced into situations that they wouldn't otherwise choose, like working wage labor because the rainforest gets cut down. They'd rather be hunting and gathering. So you see a lot of dissatisfaction around that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But there's still a large segment of these societies that it seems they're very happy just living with each other. By having close social relationships, by interacting with the rainforest, I think there's a lot of satisfaction. And that's why they seek out these kind of deeper areas, deeper in the national park there, where they can have that autonomy.
Would you say they seem more happy than people in Calgary?
I'd say so, yeah. Mm. I mean, it's just anecdotal, but sure, I'd say so.
I mean, that's profound. That's very profound. And also, I think another thing that people, I think, get confused with when thinking about the hunter-gatherer lifestyles is, you know, sure, you could have periods of time that are very difficult, you know, maybe food shortages and disease and everything. But I mean, we also have situations and places in modern life that are pretty, like, significantly worse, right? So, like, the people in the Congo mining cobalt. I mean, that's modern society right there, too. I mean, you can't, like, people in sweatshops in Southeast Asia, that's modern society, too. So, you kind of can't have your cake and eat it, too. Like, this is, yeah, I mean, we're fueled by these things. And speaking of resources, I guess that's another thing I want to tackle here is the impact of population size as we've grown into these enormous populations. You know, there's been, we talk about the meta crisis issue on this podcast, you know, this interconnected web of global catastrophic risks and all their root causes and everything. And the topic of carrying capacity is a pretty salient one. I've heard estimates from, you know, 500 million to like 4 billion people. Of course, you know, what does that really mean? Like at what standard of living and for how long is it sustainable and so on? What research has been done on, like optimal human population density from like a hunter gatherer standpoint?
Yeah, so that's a big question. If we can just kind of reframe it a little bit. So when you look at hunter gatherer groups, they are interacting with their environment in a particular way, right? They have, a given set of, tools basically to exploit an environment with. And given that set of technologies, we can ask, what population densities they reach. And of course, that's also adding on kind of like the social system that they live in. And then let's allow size to vary. What we see is that the kind of traditional hunting and gathering, like immediate return hunting and gathering life way, results in pretty low population densities. And this is because humans in this context are not getting that much environmental energy out of the earth, basically. Now, that being said, it's all relative. So relative to like a chimpanzee, humans are extraordinary at getting environmental energy. This was actually what led to the shift that gave us our big brains and our small guts and our expensive physiologies, right? So on the one hand, it was like a real revolution to be able to exploit resources the way that humans do. But that still leaves us at pretty low population density with hunter-gatherers.
Can you help us visualize that? So like, you know, if you're talking about New York City, you know, maybe just Manhattan, yeah. Like how many people are we talking?
I guess I don't know like exact numbers, but it would be like orders of magnitude difference, as in like a few people per square kilometer, right? We can think about it from this perspective. Hunter-gatherer groups, like say 25 to 30 people, moving nomadically, they'll stay in a place for about a week. And that's with foraging effort going all around the camp, getting vegetables and meat and so on. And then they kind of go somewhere else. So they've depleted that within a week of living in, let's say, this kind of pristine environment.
And that's just one group. Right?
Well, this is kind of like the modal or the most common behavior that you see in like nomadic hunter-gatherers. Yeah. And so it's like a massively far cry from, New York City. The way we're able to sustain that, of course, is through new forms of environmental exploitation, most notably fossil fuels. But the step that came before that was obviously agriculture. And by packing more, energy into a given area of land with domesticated crops, that we, you know, genetically selected to be bigger, more nutritious, and so on, then you can kind of pack more people in. And so we've had this process throughout human evolution of just getting denser and denser groups. As far as what is optimal, it kind of depends on the specific question you're asking in a given environment.
Like to minimize intertribal conflict, to minimize like, you know, spreading of pathogens, to minimize, you know, or to, let's say, maximize leisure time.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're not competing for the same, you know, resources.
And maybe minimizing ecological impact simultaneously too.
Yeah, well, all those things are going to have different, they're going to produce different models and predictions about what you should be doing. So when it comes to pathogens, like at a certain density, then living in a larger group becomes harmful, right? Or like if you stay too long in a place, you accumulate trash at a site. So you want to kind of move on from that. But if we look at just the patterns that exist, in a sense, those are actually the answers to your question. So when Bob Kelly, a very famous hunter-gatherer scholar who's an archaeologist, he said, if there's two things I would say that we could project into the past about hunter-gatherers from modern hunter-gatherers, it would be that they lived in groups of 25 to 30 and that they had sexual divisions of labor. So the fact that they live in these size groups, it suggests that the answers, it kind of contains the answers to your questions, is that this seems to be a group size that minimizes issues with pathogens, that allows maximal exploitation of an environment, that allows the problem of scalar stress to be solved, meaning you can make consensus decisions pretty easily in groups of 25 to 30. But if you look at
how would a group of 25 to 30 guarantee like genetic diversity? Or how would you avoid?
This is like the minimal band size.
Sure.
Or like the average band size. But they exist within a meta population. So there's other bands and you have interactions between the bands that are dispersing. So that solves that problem. But as far as kind of almost a super organism moving across the landscape, 25 is a pretty good number. And I'll give you another reason why, which is that with how risky human food gathering and hunting is, meaning that, again, there can be a high rate of failure because we go after things that are higher in energy density but harder to find. If that's the case, let's say we're living in a group of, let's say, just the three of us, there's a good chance that we're all going to fail on a given day. But our group isn't big enough to sustain that. But if we live in a group where there's, let's say, seven other hunters, so we have 10 of us now.
Increase your chances of success. Yeah.
Then one of you, if with a 90% failure rate, one of you is going to get food on any given day and you can share it, right? And so this is actually like the human advance, is that we were able to use our social systems to buffer our risk, right? And that's what you have in that group of 25 to 30 is like a critical size of people that you, if you all share with each other, then you can go after risky things and maintain the system. It's like a beautiful evolutionary solution to a puzzle of group life.
And that's in a huge contrast to the anonymity of individuals in modern society, right? And that's part of the reason why we are struggling to coordinate is this lack of, well, first of all, transparency. You don't know what these people are doing. You don't know who they are to begin with. Like, do you see, and I think this is like, going to go a little out there, but if you were to try to come up with a new political system for the scale of population that we have, based on what you know about hunter-gatherer decision-making, for example, like what are some ideas that come to your head?
Yeah, well, I think this is a huge issue. And are you guys familiar with like The Dawn of Everything, the book that came out a couple years ago about...
I'm familiar with
the nature of human society. Yeah, I wrote an article about this, but basically what the book is kind of getting at is this assumption that when we scale up human society, going from hunter-gatherer bands to, you know, complicated nation states like we have now, that inequality is kind of a natural result of that because of the scalar stress issue where you have to have leaders and you have to have inequality so that you can kind of have the society function, right? So the inequality kind of arises as a result of a self-optimizing system in which you are not making these consensus decisions among small groups, but you have to have leaders, right? Who are making decisions, right? You can't have an in-person discussion of 300 million people in a nation state. Right. And so you have these inequalities arise, but there's a debate about whether these are an inherent product of like the dynamics of systems and how they self-organize to be optimal, or if it's rich people preying on poor people. You see what I mean? So this is sort of the debate. And I think it gets at your question. When we look at hunter-gatherer societies, they are making decisions through consensus because you can have these face-to-face discussions. You're with the same people much of the time. And so you have to come up with a decision that everyone can live with, right? And so this is like a whole different style of politics. Maybe it's one that you practice within your home or within a close friend group, but it's certainly not the one that characterizes modern democracies where we go and cast a faceless vote and you just tally them up and the winners are the winners, the losers are the losers. And our modern political system is very much, I mean, look at the election now. It's sort of like, we want to win, we want them to lose, and it's almost like a football game, right? It's not, people aren't behaving like they live in the same society. They have to get along. So I think it's hard, though, to take the hunter-gatherer model and apply it to
a mass the modern world, yeah,
because it's a whole different scale, right? But what I have argued is that one thing that we do kind of have in common that I think we downplay too much is our interdependence, meaning we are all reliant on each other. It's just that those ways are kind of more invisible now, right? But we saw with COVID how quickly supply chains can break down, how reliant we are on stuff coming from other places. And so we all live in these really interdependent societies, but we've kind of lost the norms that you had in hunter-gatherer societies that actually knit you together to behave cooperatively toward positive goals. And frankly, I don't really have an answer for it other than like we need to readopt norms that make people kind of nicer to each other. That would help.
So maybe some sort of like hyper federated type of arrangement where like the most important political entity is something that maybe like a neighborhood council or like a block council almost.
Well, I'm a big fan of that because like I was saying earlier, I think humans are really good at assembling in small groups. And when you have these kind of intricate interdependencies at small scale, you end up with really effective collective behavior. And so I think if we were to have systems like that, I think that would be really, really fantastic. But there's just kind of this centralizing influence everywhere these days that I think removes.
Is that part of the game theory issue again, though? Because, I mean, there's decentralized decision making, but then there are still certain inherent disadvantages to that when going up against a more centralized system that wants to kill you, right? So, like, there's some lack of efficiency or something there that doesn't quite match up, which is maybe why in history we've seen this gravitation towards centralized power. And so I don't know how you ever get away from that from like a game theory standpoint. You know, it's just like, you know, if you look at it in isolation, like, yes, you want this decentralized system, but then the moment you introduce competition, you've completely changed the dynamics.
So, well, and that's why mom and pop stores go out of business, right? Because it's about efficiency, right? You introduce a big box store or Amazon or something. And these I think, more interesting kind of cooperative forms that are more based in indigenous and that like very broadly speaking, like indigenous knowledge of an area and people and local landscapes. But I think it's because our system is optimizing efficiency, like, and maybe that's the problem, is that these other kinds of cooperative forms are actually trying to maximize things like well-being and happiness, not like how quickly can you get an alarm clock from the store.
And it seems like inevitably speaking, we're facing down a conflict within the context of the biotech that this is something that their civilization is going to have to face down probably in the near term. You know, given what you've said about how the Malaysian government views them, and I'm hoping like we're not putting you in any trouble by like having you like
no, these are well known
criticize the Malaysian government. But it seems like that way of life and maybe that approach to life, even if it is the most rewarding and the greatest possible path to happiness for this people, it's inevitably going to fall into conflict with the encroachments of the rest of industrialized Malaysia, so to speak.
I think totally. But at the same time, and I think we're seeing this in our own political system in a way too, of, you know, like the anti-globalization kind of movement, where people are seeing that these smaller forms of kind of self-governance are more attractive in some ways. To kind of just talk about one like historical lesson that I've learned, when you look at the way that hunter-gatherers were studied like 100 years ago or so, one of the reasons people were really interested in studying them, they were like, these groups are disappearing. They'll be gone before we know it. And so we have to go study them. And it was kind of, they were treating it like colonialism and all these like globalizing influences 100 years ago were like this, like a tsunami that was just going to overrun these groups. And while that is true from like a certain standpoint, it's also ignoring a lot of the agency of the people in having a decision about how they lead their lives. And so even with little fragments of rainforest left, the Batak culture is alive and well. I went this, so the past two summers I've been working in an area where there's a Batak, two Batak villages of one specific sub-dialect of Batak. So we go from 2,000 speakers down to about 300 total, and they have their own separate language. And I went there and I kind of conducted a study of that language, and I'm seeing who's speaking it, taking word lists from 60 years ago and asking kids about these words, and they knew them. It means that they're passing on their language within their within this group of 300 people. And so I try to be optimistic in the sense that people have this desire to be autonomous and to be free and to maintain their cultural resilience. And I think that this is going to be like a counterbalance in some ways to these processes we're talking about as being almost overwhelming, right? So I try to maintain some hope is my conclusion.
Yeah, this, I mean, this whole discussion about, you know, the collective decision making and this competition and all that, I think that can be an episode in its own right, for sure.
Yeah, probably.
I want to end on the note of values again, because I think we kind of touched on it and then we didn't fully, you know, explore it maybe. There's a little story of the Cree in northern Canada, where back in the, I think, 18th century, European traders wanted to acquire more fur from them. And they like increased their prices, and they thought, okay, well, we're going to pay more, so they'll be more happy to give us more and more fur. But of course, like, the Cree ended up selling less to them because they got what they needed, because they didn't value this sort of idea of just continual aimless growth. And I thought that was like, that's such a profound difference when it comes to values, because the idea of like being content is almost like built in to that egalitarian-esque lifestyle. What do you have to say about like that idea of being content?
Yeah, well, I have a similar story, and I talk about this in my article about the original affluent society, where when the Batak, sometimes they're kind of forced into working wage labor jobs. They just want to get some quick money. And so this means going and working at a plantation where you get this big stick and like get palm oil fruits off the tree. And this is like, you know, in the middle of the day, it's really hot. They don't like the work. And so they'll sign a contract. They'll sign a contract to go work for like X amount of days. And they'll go and they'll just like work for a couple hours or maybe just a few days. And then they just take their money and they just leave.
Nice.
They don't fulfill their contract. So it's like the satisficing kind of perspective where it's like, well, I want to get this amount and then I'm good. I'm not like trying to put all this into my account and save for college or anything. I have enough, right? That's kind of the lesson of that. And this has been something I think about a ton because, I mean, being in academia, it's like maybe like a lot of areas, but it's like a constant treadmill of like never having enough. You always have to be expanding, basically running in the same place to keep running to stay in the same place.
You could just tell them you're embracing Batak culture as part of like your studies.
Yeah, right. But I think there is something psychologically about these cultures where they are better at just sort of being satisfied with what they have. And that's actually one way I've tried to take their lessons and think to myself, like, you know, look at what human needs are, and, you know, do you really need to go do this study or that study or write these papers? It, like, why?
Let's explore that a little bit. Yeah. Is it because of just how limited, like, your competitors are and how established things get, because you just have such a small kind of context to deal with? But the moment you scale up context, the moment you have this globalized, hyper-connected society where you're looking at people on Instagram, you know, and they've got these bodies, they've got these, you know, mates, they've got this work and lifestyle. Like, I mean, do you think that's the key difference there that's driving the contentness?
I think that's part of it. And that, you know, that goes back to like an evolutionary psychology explanation of like who you compare yourself to. But I think it's potentially very compelling. I do have one other story that I think is relevant to this. This isn't my story, but I read about it, of a hunter among the Mbenjele group in Central Africa, where there was this guy who, like in this hunter-gatherer group that has very strong egalitarian norms. And this guy loved to hunt. He just went out hunting all the time, getting a lot of stuff. And you would think that because food gets shared widely in these societies, that that would be a good thing. But it wasn't. And the reason was that it was almost like he was establishing himself as being above others by getting a lot of stuff, because that could potentially be leveraged into other currencies, maybe mates or some kind of status or political influence. And so people don't like that. They don't like when you set yourself above them. And he eventually got ostracized from the group for doing too much hunting. And so I just bring that up because I think it's a feature of these egalitarian societies that it's a part of their social world. And I think it shapes them. It shapes their preferences and how they decide to do things. So if you live in that kind of society, why would there be incentive to go and make extra money to be a baller or something? Like,
That's so funny, because we would elect that person to be president in our society.
Hey, it's right? A hustler. Like, yeah, that's right.
Well, right. And there's all sorts of like status games that people play of like, oh, I'm so busy, like I work so much, things like that. And you just don't hear stuff like that in these other societies, because it's expected that you stop at a certain point. And if you're in that environment, like, we're shaped by our environments. And so I think it would be much easier to do that. So like, going back to a point that was made earlier, I think a couple of years ago, I used to like look at our society and say, well, like, we have everything. Why would we ever be unhappy? We have so much material wealth. No one can complain in our society, even relatively lower levels of socioeconomic status. But I now see that I think about it way differently, is that we are like faced with actually a very challenging social world based on where we come from as evolutionarily evolved beings. And there's a lot of like challenges that we face that these other groups don't. And I think that they're real and profound, even if we do have relative material affluence. So I've tried to be a little bit easier on ourselves with some of this knowledge that I've gotten, because we face a lot more complicated problems, I think, than they do in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, that story, though, it just so beautifully illustrates that it just takes like one person to start throwing off the game theory dynamics. And, limited to a single tribe in a vacuum, then, you know, we've evolved that tendency to ostracize that individual and maintain the kind of egalitarian, you know, system. But it's just the moment you have, you know, other tribes involved and people start the moment you have like a couple of sociopaths that can coordinate with one another to gain more power, and like it just starts dynamics completely off.
Right.
And that's what we're struggling with, because I do think from like a personality standpoint, individual differences thing, you know, the middle of the bell curve is, I think, more suited towards that egalitarian kind of perspective, but it's just, we have people on the extreme end of the bell curve leading society in a direction that isn't even making them happier. It's just they're wired that way to be extra competitive and driven and less empathetic as a result, or because they're less empathetic, really. Right. And I think that's something I wish more people understood it's like the tyranny of the minority from the standpoint of like the type of people that become leaders and gain a lot of status in modern society. If there's a way to handle that, that would be like nice.
I know it's really hard though. And even in these societies like the Batek, we see this in action kind of in microcosm where, okay, take an example of a guy who hunts too much. Maybe he takes that stuff, maybe he takes the meat or maybe it's honey or something. He goes and now he can sell it on the outside, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than just being regulated by the group. He goes and sells it on the outside. He gets some money. He buys a motorbike. He gets some buddies involved. They accumulate a bunch of stuff. They get more resources. They build themselves bigger houses. They get more political influence. And all of a sudden you have inequality in a place where these norms would not have allowed that to flourish before. We are seeing this in action in these places. And that's what's striking about these human groups is that we don't even need to necessarily posit these like massive personality differences. I think they can be there sometimes. But mm-hmm. the thing about egalitarian social structures is that we assume that there's always kind of this drive to power and there's evidence of it constantly cropping up, but that there's a social control mechanism to make sure it doesn't get out of control. Right. But then sometimes it does when conditions change, and that's what we're seeing. And we see it to the extreme now. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the big, like, I don't want to use this term, but like thought leaders that we've discussed on this podcast, and that's kind of behind the whole meta crisis thing, is a guy named Daniel Schmachtenberger. And he's mentioned how the invention of the plow was really that defining moment where you can start to really like accumulate things to a massive extent. Right. And that accumulation process is what leads to the inequality that you're talking about. And so, yeah, it just shows you like the butterfly effect of little new inventions like that.
Right.
Not little, but
technologies.
You know, just, yeah.
They can have big changes for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a complex system. We live in a highly, highly complex system, and you just change one of the, you know, initial conditions and you almost have a new system. Yeah, right. Like exactly. The most minute, you change the most minute variable and it's completely different. And it's the reason why we can't predict the weather, right? The weather's a chaotic system. We are like reasonably accurate.
It's the weather machine that we invented. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of that, but, it's just, I also assume that's what makes, you know, studying sociology, psychology, anthropology so difficult is, you know, it's just almost impossible. Like every single study is completely different, really. So
right on.
Yeah. Well, I think we've kind of reached time here.
Okay.
Maybe final question for you. If somebody, you know, put a gun to your head, and I know in Canada there's no guns, so
that's right.
Might be hard for you to imagine, here. and they're like, hey, you have to reset your life, you know, you won't remember anything. And you had two options. You could, you know, travel back in time to 50,000 years ago and belong to a Native American tribe. And you didn't have
to deal with the fact that. Well, that wouldn't really be possible back then, but yeah.
Well, that's a good point. Okay. 12,000 years ago. Or
yeah, yeah.
Well, actually, even that's my, the land bridge thing.
But they, yeah, they yeah, keep pushing straight. Back.
Yeah.
Let's go with 20.
They do, yeah.
Yeah.
You had that option and you didn't have to worry about the infant mortality issue. You survived that part.
Sure.
Already some buffers in place, yeah.
Or you get reborn anywhere in the modern, let's say Western world today. Which would you choose?
I would choose the past, if only because it's this, this is what I do. And to be able to see an ancient society would just be so exciting for me. You know, to live in it, I wouldn't pretend that it would be like an easy life. But I think my curiosity would overwhelm me, and I would be forced to take that choice, because especially 50,000 years ago, a lot of interesting stuff was going on. Human cumulative culture was really taking off. And I think if you were in the right place at the right time, you could see, you know, one of those sparks, as they say, that really gave rise to what was to come. And I think that's like a tremendously exciting thing to have seen.
Yeah. Just one guy starting to hunt a little bit too much, and then we have halt in New York City.
It was actually Vivek all along.
Yeah.
you were the turning point. Where can people reach you if they want to find more of your work?
So I'm a professor at the University of Calgary. So if you type in Calgary and my name, you'll find my lab website where we describe our research. And I also occasionally tweet, or whatever we call it these days, post on X and
X.
Twitter.
I X.
And my handle is Vivek_Vasi, V-A-S-I. Or people are welcome to look up my email and contact me. Happy to chat.
Thanks for coming on.
Could you give
us
a farewell statement in Vatek?
Okay.
Well, what do you want me to say?
Just goodbye and have a great day.
Okay. Terima kasih, chipadet chipgoy. So that means thank you. Have a good journey or like day, sort of. And then like, sort of like take it easy, take it slow. Like chip is go. Goy is like slow. Yeah, chipgoy.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'd like
chip
that.
Make chick. Chip Goy.
Chip Goy, yeah.
Good luck on your journey.
Thanks for coming on, man. We really appreciate it. This is a great conversation.
Yeah, I had fun. Thank you.